Good morning, Texas, America, and the world. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. In just a minute, I'm going to introduce my guest, Patricia Hero, Pat Hero of New Jersey, who is a graduate of Valparaiso University in Indiana. If you're not familiar with that school, it is the largest Lutheran university in America. It's found on U.S. 30 between South Bend, Indiana, where Notre Dame is, and the Chicago Loop. So Valparaiso is right in that South Bend, Chicago nexus. Very interesting place with a lot of people that I got to know over the course of my own 4 years in that institution. She also is a graduate of the George Washington University School of Law in Washington, D.C., and was recently involved this past November in a run for a city council seat in her municipal jurisdiction in New Jersey that raises all kinds of questions related to the political process. We've been talking about that with Bob in recent minutes on the show. Does traditional political activism work anymore? That's just one of the things I want to take up with Pat here in just a second. But we were talking before this last break in regard to my own experience with the Republican Party in 1996. Offered an opportunity to be a national delegate that year, quietly behind the scenes. Indicated quietly behind the scenes that I couldn't do that because I would not vote for Bob Dole in San Diego. And I saw the nomination of Bob Dole on the part of the Republican Party as an absolute repudiation of the Texas State Republican Party platform that year as it was adopted in San Antonio in the summer of 1996 at the Alamo Dome. It was certainly a repudiation of most of what was in the party platform of the Republican Party in San Diego that emerged at the national level. And you know what was so interesting about that particular convention in San Diego? It is a matter of record. If you don't believe this, go back and take a look at all the major newspapers of that time, including the San Diego Union Tribune. I was sitting in a motel out there in Escondido waiting for the beginning of the Republican National Convention. As one of the people linked up with Pat Buchanan, I was denied entrance to the floor of that convention by Bob Dole's people. I later managed to get a guest pass from somebody who was a friend of Jesse Helms, and that was in the last day or two of the convention, so I had an opportunity to go and to listen. But I could see how choreographed and stage-managed the convention was. Mr. Dole, of course, had yet another establishment Republican, Jack Kemp, who had been selected as his running mate. But if you go back and look at the San Diego Union Tribune at that time or any of the establishment papers, including the New York Times, Bob Dole, and this was the first time that this had ever happened in my political memory, in my lifetime, he openly admitted during the course of the convention that he had not read the party platform, what didn't really care what was in it, and wasn't bound by it. The long and the short of it is, he openly proclaimed the very case that I had made to my friend behind closed doors at the Texas State Republican Convention that year in San Antonio, and that was that the party platform was irrelevant, because when you nominate candidates who are a walking repudiation of the party platform, and when in between conventions you have major party candidates, both in the presidency as well as up on Capitol Hill, who have worked to destroy our country, globalist trade treatment, treaties, the destruction of the manufacturing sector of our economy, a no-win war of counterinsurgency in Iraq, the ongoing influence of the Israeli lobby. It just goes on. And that gets to the bottom of what Bob was talking about in regard to the falsehood that was invading Pergamos in the first century in Asia Minor. dwelling where Satan's seat is, and the deification of the central state. We'll be back with Pat Hero.
Learn about the new discoveries of MSP Research. Find out about the success MDs, dentists, veterinarians, and others are having with Silver 500. Learn secrets to survival, how to detox the liver, gallbladder, and kidneys, and how over 1,100 doctors are treating Lyme disease, hepatitis C, diabetes, respiratory infections, and many more with success thanks to the help of MSP Research and Silver 500. Microbiologists have tested our mild silver protein and found Silver 500 to be the most effective treatment for B. subtilis, a subgroup of anthrax. Choose the products in your medical supply wisely. Our doctor's manual has grown to over 600 pages. Give us a call at 1-334-493-0420. That's 1-334-493-0420. And see why doctors in five countries use a dozen products that are manufactured by Dr. Bill McFarland. One more time, that's 1-334-493-0420. Or visit our website at www.mildsilverprotein.com/home.html.
Obviously, something serious is going on, politically, economically, geologically, and environmentally. And how you prepare for those changes will determine your well-being in the very near future. Now, whether you're preparing for your family, your business, or your country, the Survival Center has the knowledge and experience to assist you in those decisions. Survival Center is America's premier supplier of family preparedness, health, and survival supplies with over 33 years of continuous operation. Now, you can start preparing with just knowledge, and that's why the Survival Center is offering a book. It's called Basic Preparedness, and it's just $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And it'll teach you about the four basics of survival: food, water, medical, and shelter. And when you order that book, you'll also get a free Survival Center catalog. Contact us today so we can help you prepare for whatever comes your way. Call us toll-free at 1-800-321-2900 or online at www.survivalcenter.com.
Attention, this is an RBN Financial News Bulletin. Have you ever wanted to get out of debt, maybe even make some of your debts disappear completely? If so, and you're an RBN listener, there is a very real chance you will be able to do it. Here is why. A new manual has just been published that reveals how you can get out of debt in 90 minutes without any loans or bankruptcy whatsoever. The insider secrets revealed allow you to get out of debt so fast and so completely that it makes some people feel like they're stealing, but they're not stealing. The secrets taught in the manual are 100% legal and 100% ethical. It's just that bankers, debt collectors, and credit card companies don't want you to know about these loopholes. Don't be a prisoner of debt. Go to outin90.com. That's www.outin90.com or call 877-327-0365. RBN listeners receive a free DVD with purchase.
We're back. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Before I bring Pat Hero on, I just wanted to draw your attention to another interesting story at CNN.com. Keep an eye on this one. They're reporting from London that British police have questioned Tony Blair for a second time as a part of an investigation into political party funding. This has something to do with allegations that Blair's ruling Labour Party promised honors, including seats in the upper house of lords and knighthoods, in return for loans to help a 2005 general election campaign. And you know, his close aide, Ruth Turner, was arrested on January 19th on suspicion of linkage to this whole thing. And shortly before Blair came on to discuss some of these things with the cops in this latest situation, his longtime chief fundraiser, Michael Levy, was arrested as well. What's going on here? Keep an eye on it, folks, because it may suggest that not all is well with Tony Blair's political fortunes in England. To what extent does this have something to do with other matters that are not directly linked to political allegations of corrupt fundraising? We'll see. Pat Hero, how are you? Are you on?
Mark?
Yeah, this is Mark Dankoff. Pat, how you doing?
Pretty good, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. I was just telling the listeners a little bit today about a couple of news items, and in the first 2 hours of the show, talking about a series of things that suggest, at least to me, that participation in the present political process is maybe of dubious value in regard to actually changing the course of direction of the country. Just as one example of this, I had mentioned today the lead story in CNN on their interactive that Carl Levin of Michigan and John Warner of Virginia had supposedly begun a process of collaboration in regard to opposing Bush's troop surge in Iraq, and yet the resolution is non-binding. There's nothing there that deals with defunding this process, and a number of people have apparently set off the record up on the Hill that in the Senate they would vote for some sort of a Warner-Levin compromise if it preserved their right to continue funding the situation in Iraq. And I was saying to the listeners that this shows a real disconnect between a political position where somebody says, hey, yeah, I oppose what's going on in Iraq, I oppose the war, or at least oppose Bush's policies on this and oppose the troop surge. Nonetheless, I want to preserve my political right to continue funding these things. Is this an example, in your judgment, of the wider issue of a lack of political accountability that you see not simply at the federal level, but at the state level and the local level?
Well, I'd certainly like to read more about it. But I do think that political activism is not dead yet. I mean, I do think, especially on the local level, that one has an opportunity to make an impact. I think I certainly have done so in my community.
Yeah, I had, before you came on this morning, I was indicating that I was going to raise this issue with you specifically because you have a very fascinating personal and political history. And, of course, both you and I have been involved in, to some degree, in political activism for a long time. I did my U.S. Senate thing in 2000 for the Constitution Party. You know, this past year you were involved in this and running for a city council seat in New Jersey. Why do you believe at this juncture that your involvement in this process had merit?
Well, I think Gandhi said it best, be the change you want to see in this world. I can't tell somebody to do anything unless I'm doing it myself, and I'm always trying to take it to the next level. First, it was going to city council meetings. Then it was going to library board and planning board meetings. Then it was running for office. And while my I did not get the office that I sought, which was council person, I did make a lot of impact. I mean, now it's not just me when I appear at the podium. They also know that 363 other people in my ward supported me.
Yes, and what began that whole process for you in terms of deciding to run? I know you've been very involved in the eminent domain issue up there. Was that the galvanizing force behind your candidacy?
It definitely was, because I was talking at the city council meetings about the Kelo case before the decision was even reached by the Supreme Court, because I knew it was in the pipeline. And I was very saddened when it came down, because I thought it pretty much decimated what the Founding Fathers had intended for the for the property rights provision of the Fifth Amendment.
For those of us not familiar with the Kelo decision that came out of the Supreme Court, just in summation, what was it, and what do you see as the implications of what they decided?
Well, basically, Suzette Kelo had a home in New London, and the Pfizer Corporation wanted to, you know, have a new development, and of course the city was all for it, and they wanted high-end condominiums and, build, I guess, a complex, you know, for themselves also. But that meant that Ms. Kelo's home and the homes of other people in that neighborhood, she was the lead plaintiff, but there were other plaintiffs in that case, had to go. And so it went through the court system, finally wound up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled against her. And as Sandra Day O'Connor said, the results will not be, you know, anybody's home can be taken now. You know, any, like a motel could be taken, Motel 6 could be taken and replaced by Ritz-Carlton. And the results were disproportionate because it's mostly poor minorities that will be affected at the, for the benefit of the corporations.
Yeah, and to me, I see it as, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I look at this Kelo decision, and it seems to be an extension of what I would argue is a complete corporate takeover of the American political process. For example, you take the Iraq War. Dr. Richard Cummings was on this show on Monday. He's a member of the Association of Retired Intelligence Officers, went to Princeton and Cambridge. Was an agency for international development guy for years in both Jordan and Israel. He's a consultant for Pat Buchanan's publication on Middle Eastern affairs, and he effectively argues in a piece that he has written that has been published at Playboy magazine, of all places, that the Lockheed Corporation has played a disproportionate role in all of the things that have surrounded the Iraq War in terms of not simply going in, but in regard to the particular strategy that Rumsfeld and his crew had been pursuing with only a limited number of ground troops. And without reopening that debate again this morning, Cummings made a pretty convincing case for the fact that here you have a major corporate lobby that was not only instrumental in working behind the scenes to ensure that we did go to war in Iraq, if one accepts Cummings' model, and he made a very convincing case for it on Monday, but that even the strategy that was being pursued in Iraq subsequent to entry was reflective of in this particular case, the nation's leading aerospace firm. Isn't that, in some respects, connected to the Kelo decision in that whether you're talking about foreign policy and defense contractors and war profiteering on the one hand, or on the other, you're speaking about an imminent domain issue where, an individual zoning commission or city council or whatever it happens to be can be bought off rather easily by corporate entities that simply then get these guys to legitimize legally what these fellows want, which is to confiscate everybody else's property and to basically centralize more political and economic power and largesse in their own coffers.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure I'd use the words bought off, for example. But I would say that they are, for example, you don't have to use eminent domain to redevelop. For example, Disney didn't use it. Even when they went into Northern Virginia for their failed, I think, Disney America project, they negotiated with the individual landowners. Now, that project failed, but that was because there was an upcry about the nature of the project, not because they used eminent domain. They didn't. You can read in Northern Virginia, where I used to live in Arlington, they redeveloped without using eminent domain, at least in the places that I had lived. So you don't have to use eminent domain to redevelop. In fact, Chris Norby has a website, Municipal, I think, Officials for Redevelopment Reform in California. You probably just look up Chris Norby and get that website. But he says that it's actually more effective when the government doesn't use eminent domain, when the private sector just redevelops. I think it's better for individuals to have to negotiate rather than the government coming in and saying, we're going to have this great project. For example, we have a project that's the city declared an area in need of redevelopment, and it was taken off the tax rolls, and now it's just sitting there. And now they say, well, there's problems with rats and everything, and those businesses were closed, and now we're just waiting for the developer to move on that.
Yes, and so it seems to me that in the getting back to the Kelo case for a minute, that what seems to be especially ominous there is that even if a particular corporation does not choose, or a series of corporations do not choose to exercise this so-called right, as it was seen by the Supreme Court in the Kelo decision, that essentially that mechanism is there, is it not, if in fact more traditional methods of negotiation with individual property owners fail. We'll get back to this when we return. This is Mark Dankoff's America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned for Pat Hero. We'll be back.
People who use Cartavite know about the pollutants in our body and want them out. For over 5 years, Cartavite has proven itself time-tested. Here's Dr. Mattson, a naturopathic doctor's thoughts on Cartavite.
In our mind, there isn't such a great big mystery to disease anymore. This basic tenet of yeast in the gut and metals in the liver covers at least 70-80% of the diseases that we see. When we do our program, you know, herbal formulas like Cartavite, and you see someone who could barely walk up a hill now going for regular jogs, 2 months later, we know we're doing something right. It's a well-thought-out formula. I mean, the idea of it working on yeast and metals both at the same time and liver function is dead on. You'll find, I think, that it'll work more than just on heart problems and circulation problems. It'll work on other problems as well.
For more information, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit our Cartavite link at rbnlive.com. That toll-free number again, 1-877-928-8822. 8822.
Would you enjoy a career where you pick your hours, work for who you want to, when you want to, as much as you want to? No one knows about this hidden career because there is no book, school, or teaching material available until now. Learn the trade of window painting. Window Genie is now offering a 3-day workshop on DVD that shows you how to reproduce art, text, and graphics professionally, even if you can't draw a stick man. Secrets, cheater techniques, shortcuts, tips, and tricks are all revealed. Recoup your investment in as little as one job and have a career for life. This training also gives you the skills to do regular sign work, indoor murals, and signage. Begin your new career today. Just call us at 780-457-7109 or visit us at windowgenie.com. Again, that's Window Genie, spelled JEANNIE.com.
Can you grow your own nutrition on a shelf indoors in 10 days? Wheatgrass juice is live superfood, the richest nutritional liquid known to man, packed with amino acids, living enzymes, and over 100 elements. 2 ounces of juice have the same nutrition as 3 pounds of choice garden produce. Call 1-877-699-4328. That's 1-877-MY-WHEAT. The stamina, healing, blood building, weight control, and cleansing are just the beginnings of what you will reap from pennies worth of grain. For the book, seed, and the beautiful stainless steel hand crank wheatgrass juicer for $150 plus shipping. No monthly pills, no monthly bills. This is real self-sufficiency. Go to AustinWheatgrass.com or call toll-free 1-877-MY-WHEAT. That's 1-877-699-4328. And thank you for your support of our labors and of the RBN Network.
Back. This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We're joined today by Pat Hero, H-E-R-O of New Jersey, graduate of Valparaiso University and also the George Washington University School of Law in Washington, D.C. Pat was involved in a city council race up there in New Jersey that first and foremost for her involved the eminent domain issue. It may subsequently have branched out into a series of other things as well. Pat, what would you say in regard to your run for this thing, which, of course, you did not win, but you got a significant number of votes? What would you say was the upshot and the downshot of your run? What was what you would say a good thing in regard to what you have accomplished here? What would you say would have been the big disappointments in the whole thing?
Well, I guess the major disappointment was, of course, that I didn't win. The upshots are quite a few. One is I really do get along well with the person who ran, and I think that was a very positive thing. I deliberately decided during the campaign that I wasn't going to run a negative campaign, and I didn't. And we even sat down and talked this past Monday on the issues that concerned the ward, so I was able to help in that regard. Another upside is in going around, a lot of people recognized me from TV 36. As one woman said, which is the local cable channel where the city council meetings are on. She goes, I see you on TV 36, and everything you say is honest. And so, I mean, I think that was really, really great. And, of course, having 365 votes, one being my own, of course, but 364 people saying, you know, we're behind you, and my supporters were very, very supportive.
Did you find when you were talking with people, and I have a reason for asking this, I better explain the context for this question. When I was running against William Roth and Tom Carper in the U.S. Senate race up in Delaware in 2000, I was encountering within what one would assume would be my own political constituency, which would be the America First, Taft Republican, Buchanan Republican crowd, that a significant number of those people were, of course, very friendly to me and very good people, but a significant number I found that year to be somewhat disillusioned with the political process in general and somehow feeling that even in voting for a third-party protest candidate, which I certainly was that year, that beyond a vote for somebody like me as an expression of their own discontent and unhappiness over the turns of events of the last half century or so, that they felt otherwise rather unempowered to do anything beyond that. Does that differ from what you were finding in this situation up there in the ward in New Jersey? Were you finding that there were more optimistic people that were feeling that voting for you or being involved in the process generally might actually lead long term to some constructive change?
There was some of that, and I have to say that one of the great positive things about it was I, in sitting down and talking with people, managed to get people to even register to vote who were disillusioned with the process. They got to know me, and they believed in me, and so got to register to vote. But then there were some people who either said, well, I just vote for president, and not realizing, of course, that your local race has far more impact on how you live your daily lives and has far more impact on the actual race itself than one vote among how many millions in the presidential race. And another thing was that some people just said, well, I'm just too busy to vote. And it's like you even said, well, I can give you an absentee ballot. You know, you don't even have to go to the polls. And it was like that was very disillusioning to me. A lot of people just weren't even interested in the process. They didn't even care, and that was very disillusioning.
Yes, and you know, you raised some good subsidiary points in all of this too. I found in dealing with the news media, that was a big thing for me up in Delaware. I got more news coverage in that state than you might imagine because I literally did not raise a dime. I found that just trying to deal with the Federal Election Commission, in my particular case, just so that the listeners understand this, I didn't have any money. I had no significant state political organization with the Constitution Party in Delaware to rely upon for any sort of precinct or county work on my behalf. I was the whole thing. I was the candidate. I was the press secretary. I was the liaison with the media. I was putting together my own position papers and so forth. And yet, for some very curious reasons in Delaware that may not extrapolate to the rest of the country, I got some coverage, some front page coverage on a couple of occasions in several of the state dailies. I was on CNN a few times in the 2 weeks leading up to the first Tuesday of November in the year 2000. So it one level was kind of interesting that I was getting some print and electronic coverage under circumstances that would normally dictate that I wouldn't. But even so, it was minuscule for obvious reasons compared to the major party candidates. I did get some negative media coverage from a guy in Dover and one in Wilmington who don't like conservatives. But we'll be back because I want to take up something related to this whole theme with the media. This is Mark Gantkoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Back with Pat Hero. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Be
because you can handle the truth.
Attention, this is an RBN Financial News Bulletin. Have you ever wanted to get out of debt, maybe even make some of your debts disappear completely? If so, and you're an RBN listener, there is a very real chance you will be able to do it. Here is why. A new manual has just been published that reveals how you can get out of debt in 90 minutes without any loans or bankruptcy whatsoever. The insider secrets revealed allow you to get out of debt so fast and so completely that it makes some people feel like they're stealing, but they're not stealing. The secrets taught in the manual are 100% legal and 100% ethical. It's just that bankers, debt collectors, and credit card companies don't want you to know about these loopholes. Don't be a prisoner of debt. Go to outin90.com. That's www.outin90.com or call 877-327-0365. RBN listeners receive a free DVD with purchase.
Come on, Bill. 2 weeks ago, you were riding a bicycle, and today you're showing up in your new car and telling me you're buying a house? What did you do, rob Bill Gates?
No, John, I didn't rob Bill Gates. What I did do is visit the website www.didyourobbillgates.com. That's where I learned how to make $3,000 to $9,000 each and every week, starting with my very first week. It's a simple program that does all the work for you. I'm already up to $25,000 just going on my third week.
Whoa. What was that website again?
It's www.didyourobbillgates.com. Now write this down, John. You should go there and learn how this program can help you become financially independent, too.
Thanks, Bill. I'm going there right now.
Check, please.
You got this one, right, Bill?
Sure, John. Don't forget, it's www.didyourobbillgates.com. Next time, you'll be buying me lunch.
Deal.
The Idaho Observer is one of the last independent American presses and isn't afraid to print the truth. The Idaho Observer is a monthly 24-page hard copy newspaper in its fifth year of addressing important issues affecting all freedom-loving Americans. If you are concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you, then subscribe to the Idaho Observer. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues. Idaho Observer readers receive vital insight into events as they unfold. Our articles editorially emphasize activism and serve as a networking tool for like-minded individuals determined to make a difference. The Idaho Observer, printing what you need to be fully informed on issues that matter to real Americans. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307. That's 208-255-2307.
This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest in the last half hour here is going to be Pat Hero, graduate of Valparaiso University in Indiana, graduate of the George Washington University School of Law, and a political candidate this past fall in a city council race up in New Jersey. Pat, I was just getting ready to say, in terms of my own relations with the news media, as a third-party candidate in this U.S. Senate race in Delaware, that I got more coverage than I thought I would, both from the state dailies there as well as from CNN, and discovered as well that there was one guy in particular who was gunning for me in the state dailies. I handled the situation well, and he finally backed off because I think he recognized he was giving me more ink than he wanted to by coming after me on some issues related to what I actually believe about a whole series of things in public policy. But this whole thing of media, how did you deal with that in your race? Were you ignored, or was there some hostility, or did you find that to a certain extent, at least at the local level, you managed to make some headway with it?
Well, basically, my first, and I'll go back to when I was, when I first appeared before the city council, my first speech was related to the closing of two branch libraries without giving any notice to the public that that was going to be done. It was done at a library board meeting, and they didn't even say that this was going to be taking effect. It just was a vote. It was done, and nobody really knew about it. So basically, I gave that speech at the city council about how unfair this was, and I was doing a petition drive, at which point two members of the media ran up to me, and that was about three years ago. So since then, I have had relations with the media even before I ran for office. So I think that was the good thing. I mean, I knew them, they knew me. Two of the papers, one was a local paper, one was a state paper, and they really didn't focus that much on my campaign. They had one story, but not really focused that much on my campaign because obviously they had other issues to cover, and the mayor's race was far more important. We had a mayor's race as well as two city council races at the time. So they were more concerned about the mayor's race than individual city council races. But there was one story in the paper, and they treated me fairly. I was told I was going to be on one website for another local paper. And then, of course, there was another local paper which it came out and endorsed me. But unfortunately, they did make a comment that I didn't want to lay off a lot of employees. And I went back to them and asked for a clarification because the fact is, I said in the interview that I didn't want to lay off any employees. And so, you know, I mean, but I've normally had really great relationships with the media. And, but I, you know, I did say to the reporter afterwards, you know, I do, you know, I said my position, that's my position, is I didn't want to lay off any employees, and said I didn't want to lay off a lot, implied that I wanted to lay off maybe some. And how many, you know, not a lot, how many did I want to lay off? And I thought that was really kind of misleading to my position. And it's little things like that. You know, sometimes you don't know what makes or breaks an election. You know what I mean? There are all sorts of factors that come into play there.
Yeah, you know, this whole thing with media is very interesting if you are a third party or an independent candidate in particular, because I know of a case that I cannot cite on the air in terms of the person and the race and the state in question. I'll simply say that it was one of the most important and significant races in the country this past first Tuesday in November. And this particular individual that I'm thinking of was running as a third-party candidate and was having a real impact in that race because it was a close race, it was nationally significant, the media was covering it, and so forth and so on. And this particular person had reason to believe on the basis of some individual polls that they were going to come in at possibly as high as 3%, which for a first-time candidate in a major political race of the magnitude of this one is a very impressive showing. And that 3% stood as the dividing line between the two major party candidates who were in a virtual photo finish up to that point. And this person was telling me off the record that they had given an interview to a major wire service that had contacted them. They thought that the wire service reporter was good and asked the right questions and seemed to be insightful and so forth. This same political candidate later discovered, however, that when this story ran nationally about them, that it indicated that they had decided to get out of the race. And there was no suggestion at all of this in this candidate's conversation with this wire service reporter. But the practical effect of what happened was that instead of getting 3%, the totals went down to somewhere between it was less than 1%. I'm going to say it was half of 1% by the time of election day, so that no matter how many clarifications were issued, how many subsequent statements were made on the part of the candidate trying to correct this misimpression, it would appear to me that they in fact had been sabotaged by a wire service reporter for who knows what nefarious purpose, but it quite clearly to me demonstrated that some very, very significant people in the political establishment were horrified at the notion that this particular person would get 3% of the vote in this very important nationally publicized race, and that something had to be done about that. Did you ever sense, in terms of your own dealings with the news media there at the local level, and you mentioned this particular thing about what you actually said about not laying off employees, do you think that was an innocent mistake on their part, or do you think that there was something potentially more nefarious involved?
No, I think it was an innocent mistake on their part.
In that case, okay.
In that case, yeah. I mean, that reporter had always been fair to me. And when I went back and asked for a clarification, you know, they reviewed it and said I was definitely entitled to one and issued a clarification. And I'm on good terms with the people in that paper. And, in fact, they did endorse me.
Yes. And, you know, I always found that it was most important to me when I was speaking to the reporters of these establishment outlets, and keeping in mind that my particular race did get some coverage with CNN. Got a little bit of coverage not only in the major dailies in Delaware, but because of the fact that Wilmington is, you might argue, a bedroom community for Wall Street. Some of what I was saying did get into several of the major Eastern dailies toward the very end of the race. In my case, after my dealings with this one guy for a major state daily in Delaware who was quite obvious – It was obviously perceiving himself as in an adversarial role against me, did not like my views on abortion, did not like my views on gun control, did not like my views when it came to the homosexual rights lobby, did not like my views on globalization. The list goes on and on. And very early in my interaction with this guy, it became apparent that he was someone who would do whatever he could to hurt me in what I perceived to be unfair ways. So in future conversations that I would have with this gentleman when he would call, I would ask for permission to tape the conversations so that we had an absolute public record of what was asked. We had an absolute public record in terms of what was said, so that if there were any questions in regard to future stories on me emanating from this reporter with this particular publication in the state of Delaware, that there would be an objective database, so to speak, to go back to say, hey, this is not what was said. This is the context for the remark. This is the question that was asked originally that prompted the remark. This needs to be clarified for public purview. If you were running in a statewide or a federal race, do you think that would be a good idea if you were an independent or third-party candidate, or do you think that the media has more honor connected with it than I do?
Well, I happen to have been a disc jockey and a news person at my college radio stations, so I do have a soft spot in my heart for the media. I think a lot of times you know, they do get it right, and when they do get it wrong, I mean, it depends on the circumstances. Obviously, in your case, that was probably, you know, that may have been a good idea. So far, I haven't had that, you know, issue, because the reporters I've dealt with have always been fair.
Yes. Well, let me ask you something. I, of course, know a lot more about you than the listeners do, because I've known you for 30 years. And you've been involved in over the years in all kinds of political issues. I think you've changed ideologically over the years at the same time that you've retained certain constants. If you had to, at a national level, point to a single issue that gives you the greatest amount of concern in regard to where we're headed, and that is something that should receive the most attention on the part of both political candidates as well as people who vote for political candidates, what particular issue right now would you select?
Well, I guess I could quote the title of Lou Dobbs' book, The War Against the Middle Class. And ironically enough, in his book, and this is before his book came out, I actually did what he suggested was the number one thing to do, is to resign. They said to resign from your party. Like, if you're a Democrat, just become independent. And if you're Republican, just go down to the voting, you know, Board of Elections and sign up to be an independent. I think both parties are probably taking the average citizen for granted.
Yeah, you know, and the reason I asked the question that I did is that, and I don't know if this will happen for you or not, I suspect it probably won't, because I think the eminent domain issue that you selected as the kind of the centerpiece of your campaign is an outsider to all of this, and particularly the state of New Jersey. It makes a lot of sense to me. I was thinking one night, gee, if I was Pat Hero and I was running for city council in this race, what would be my centerpiece issue, front and center? And I think the eminent domain thing was probably a good choice. In my particular case, and of course, keeping in mind that this was prior to September 11th, 2001, that I was running, I think without question, if I was running today in Delaware or anywhere else as a U.S. Senate candidate, that for me, maybe the overarching theme that I would select would be globalization. And what I would argue are the negative or evil effects of globalization. And I would proceed from that umbrella concept to then talk about the war in Iraq, to talk about a globally managed economy and what it means for our economic and political rights. I certainly would emphasize what I think are the draconian police state measures that have been adopted in this country since 2001. I'm referring to things like the USA Patriot Acts 1 and 2, the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and the warrantless NSA surveillance of American citizens. Those would be some of the things that I would really, really hit this time. And I guess the what I'm suggesting here is that sometimes a very good person runs for political office, and after the whole thing is over, sometimes it's a week later, sometimes it's 6 months later, sometimes it's 10 years later, you look back and you think, boy, I learned a lot about that. And if I had to do it over again and was in those same circumstances now, these are the things that I would choose to bring to the fore if I was asking people to vote for me. Do you think you'll be undergoing that kind of reassessment in the days ahead?
Well, actually, when you said, like, eminent domain, it was one of my issues. It was not, I had reducing spending or traffic safety issues, and recently we had two accidents on the same day in my ward just last week. So it shows, you know, how important that issue is in our town, and eminent domain. In fact, people did not want me to bring up the eminent domain issue. Ironically enough, I was told, you know, not to mention it until after November. And since that basically puts the gas in my engine, and I just couldn't do that. You know, I think reasonable redevelopment that doesn't displace people and businesses is very, very important. We can redevelop a community without using eminent domain.
What were the types of people that were asking you to obfuscate on that issue, and why do you think they ask you not to talk about eminent domain?
Well, I think they think it's not an issue, although my city's involved in one lawsuit with regard to that. I don't know the status of it right now, but I know they have been involved in a lawsuit. Whether they're going to be settling that or not, I really have no way of knowing. You know, it certainly concerns me. So I live off a street that's declared an area in need of redevelopment, and in other areas they have gone in, you know, to take a near block. So to me it's a concern. I had a friend of mine involved in her farm that's been in the family for 80 years taken away in Piscataway. And she used to live in my community. We went to high school together. So it's very, very, you know, it's an issue that's very, very close to my heart. And also part of the problem is while we had a manufacturing base in our town, a lot of the manufacturers have moved away or closed up businesses in our town. So we're losing that tax base. And they look to see what can we replace, you know, that lost revenue with. So it's, you know, it's kind of really kind of tied in together.
Yeah, it sounds like some of the ravages of what has happened to the manufacturing sector of the American economy have been happening up there in New Jersey. Is that accurate?
Very much so.
Yes. And I suspect that this is the same thing that's being you know, portrayed all the way across the country in regard to what was once a very vibrant American middle class. You cited Lou Dobbs in his most recent book. Do you think that the middle class in this country is an endangered species? Do you think that the battles that it seeks to wage for its own preservation have been largely lost? Or do you think that the broad-based American middle class can be recovered again?
You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, but somebody has to wake up and start paying attention. I'm just glad that, you know, Lou Dobbs is doing it. You know, addressing these issues and bringing it to the forefront. I just wish other people in the media, of course, you're doing a fine job with that, but, you know, other people in the media would start doing raise the alarm. And people have to wake up, too.
We'll be back with Pat Hero. This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, and the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned.
Would you enjoy a career where you pick your hours, work for who you want to, when you want to, as much as you want to? No one knows about this hidden career because there is no book, school, or teaching material available. Until now. Learn the trade of window painting. Window Genie is now offering a 3-day workshop on DVD that shows you how to reproduce art, text, and graphics professionally, even if you can't draw a stick man. Secrets, cheater techniques, shortcuts, tips, and tricks are all revealed. Recoup your investment in as little as one job and have a career for life. This training also gives you the skills to do regular sign work, indoor murals, and signage. Begin your new career today. Just call us at 780-457-7109 or visit us at windowgenie.com. Again, that's Window Genie, spelled JEANNIE.com.
Do you suffer from frequent and severe headaches? Well, you don't have to any longer. Headache Stay Gone is an all-natural headache remedy that is free of all side effects. Headache Stay Gone will cure any headache and prevent it from returning again. Painkillers can offer temporary relief at best, along with a long list of harmful side effects. Headache Stay Gone uses all natural ingredients and cures your headache, letting you enjoy more time with your family and loved ones. We'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone today and send you the bill. Wait until your headache is cured before you pay for it. That's right, Headache Stay Gone must work for you before you pay for it. Try Headache Stay Gone risk-free by calling 1-800-327-0727 or visit www.headachestaygone.com. Again, that's 1-800-327-0727. And don't forget to ask about your risk-free trial today. Call now. Start living life without the headaches.
Take the heat out of your sleep. The Bedfan Personal Cooling System will work for anyone that is a hot sleeper, regardless of the reason. It gives you a deep, restful sleep, the way nature intended. No more tossing and turning. Say goodbye to sleepless nights. So ask yourself, are you a hot sleeper and really want to sleep cooler? A woman who suffers from the effects of menopause, including night sweats derived from hot flashes, have a medical condition that causes your body to get hot at night, or just want to save money on your air conditioning bill. It works instantly. No tools or assembly required. Don't worry. The Bedfan fits short beds, tall beds, beds with footboards, sleigh beds, water beds, and many other types of beds. If you want great relief and total comfort, give us a call at 1-210-632-8280. That's 1-210-632-8280. Or visit our site at bedfan.com. Your provider for great sleep.
This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, and the Republic Broadcasting Network. About 6 minutes left in the show before I'm signing off for the day. I'll see you tomorrow morning, of course. And getting back to Pat Hero here, Pat, I noticed that some things I was writing about and talking about in the 2004 presidential election, that was 4 years after I ran, but by this time, of course, 9/11 had happened, and I was getting into the swing of things in regard to writing about Iran, which is a country where I lived many, many years ago. And I was certainly saying earlier than 2004, but really hitting on it in 2004, that I felt that the United States was ultimately moving toward a preemptive military action against Tehran. Is in regard to an issue of that sort, do you think that that's going to happen? I'm noticing that Jim Crane and Robert Reed of the AP have a major post today entitled U.S.-Iran Tensions Could Trigger War. Do you think we're going to be going to war with Iran in the next year? And whether you think that or not, what are the people up there in New Jersey saying in regard to this whole situation in the Middle East where it pertains to American foreign policy?
Well, I think people up here definitely support the troops, in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, I think it's, the war is definitely on people's minds, and people are very, very much concerned about it because it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to get out of there anytime soon. And, of course, if we do expand to Iran, which I certainly hope we don't, I mean, that could even be more cataclysmic. So,
yeah, that's definitely my reading of the situation. Now, as far as your reading of American politics, and again, I've known you for 30 years, and I know that you read about these things. You think very well. You're an attorney. You analyze things on a very fascinating and effective basis. Do you foresee that there is going to be, in this country, a resumption of the type of anti-war movement that we had during the Vietnam period, and maybe with a much wider political spectrum being involved in it than was the case in the 1960s? Or is your suspicion that the American public is pretty much going to passively accept this over time?
No, I think the anti-war movement has already started. I mean, there's, many demonstrations. I think they just had one in Washington, if I'm not mistaken. So I do think, the starts of the movement is already there.
Yeah, and it seems to me that, and I, of course, was hinting at that in my own question here. The thing that strikes me on this is that I see the seeds of a much wider anti-war movement politically this time around than was the case in the 1960s, when people who were perceived as being on the so-called far left, with a couple of notable exceptions, were by and large the folks that were in the vanguard of the anti-war movement at that time. Whereas today it seems to me that in addition to the fact that at least a few of those people have reappeared this time around, that there are also some forces in the middle and on the America First wing of the conservative movement in the United States that are beginning to make their own presence felt in this situation. Pat Hero, I'd like to thank you for being on Mark Dankoff's America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I will be back tomorrow morning with more news analysis and also to talk about a 50,000-watt station in Memphis, Tennessee that's picking up this broadcast as of Monday, and telling you a little bit more about where I hope to take this show in coming weeks and months. See you tomorrow. God bless.